Welcome to Cat Chat and Dog Talk. I'm Tracy Hotchner, here with my co-host, Dr. Sean, the natural vet, who's an integrative, holistic vet who can help you make good decisions for your pet's wellness. We love cats and dogs and the people who care for them. We're here every week to take your calls about your pets, and we'll answer on the air any question you send us to radiopetlady@gmail.com. Also, send your mailing address for a sample of Whole Life Pets freeze-dried protein treats for cats and dogs. Please check out all the wonderful pet shows I co-host every week on our network. Tomorrow is Dog Travel Experts, with all the ways to get out of the house with your dog from around the block to around the world. Cat Chat and Dog Talk is a production of Eight Paws LLC and Dr. Sean Messonnier, DVM PC, which are solely responsible for its content. And we'd like to thank our sponsors, companies we've invited to be here. Our number is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. We'd love to hear from you. And I have a treat for you tonight. A different Dr. Sean is my co-host tonight. The usual regular Dr. Sean, the natural vet, is away at a vet conference. So I have snagged one of my other wonderful Radio Pet Lady Network co-hosts, Dr. Sean Delaney, from Pet Food Advisors. Those of you who haven't had a chance to listen yet, it's pretty interesting. It's Thursday nights at 9 o'clock East, 6 p.m. West, right after It's a Dog's Life with Greg Kleva. And Dr. Sean, I just want to thank you. This is a busman's holiday, right? You get a break from doing Pet Food Advisors, and you get to come to another Radio Pet Lady Network show. It's not much time off, but it's really great to have you here.
It's my pleasure. I'm glad to be here.
Well, here's the thing folks need to know. If you have pet food questions, and honestly, which of us does not have a pet food question? Seems to me to be the sort of questions that burn holes in everybody's brains. This is a great night to ask because, you know, I have very strong, passionate feelings about pet food issues, but Dr. Sean Delaney has very serious information and facts and science about it. And sometimes those things mesh and sometimes they clash, and we always, on our own show, Pet Food Advisors, have a very interesting time discussing these things respectfully. It was going to be respectful sort of disagreements, but it's really hard to disagree with you, Dr. Sean. You're so charming and you're so smart. It's like, okay, fine. I guess that's something that I didn't know. Here's our number, 888-627-6008. I'd love to talk for a second about your amazing textbook, which I immediately went out and bought, and I don't think everyone's going to run out and buy it because it is a textbook and therefore it's expensive. But I know that a lot of veterinary students were pretty excited that a book had been written and edited by you and by another doctor that wasn't underwritten by a pet food company. I think something that people are beginning to know, not everyone may know, but I'm here to tell y'all that until Dr. Delaney edited this book, which is called, the snappy title, Applied Veterinary Clinical Nutrition, but it's really interesting if you're interested in pet food, all the books that existed had been paid for and therefore to some degree influenced by a commercial pet food company. They paid for the books and they gave them away. And when you consider that a textbook can cost $100, how many textbooks would you say a vet student has to buy in the 3 or 4 years in vet school, Dr. Sean? Like 100?
No, it's not that many. If I go back to my days in vet school, it's probably a half a bookshelf's worth. But the problem, as you allude to, is it's a high cost. And it's because there's not long runs on textbooks. Some of this is very niche, and it's not something that everyone wants to pick up. Having said that, I think that the textbook that we put together does have a lot of application, not just for veterinary students, but veterinarians as practitioners and then also specialists in the field. And that's why we put it together. And I think it's readable even by the layperson. And there's some areas that may not be of interest, but I think it's something that we did in the hopes that we'd put together. Not that there was bad resources, but we were very fortunate to be able to put about 20 different specialists together to write different areas of the textbook in their areas of expertise, which is very unusual. And so it's a rich resource, not really because of my contributions, but because of all the other folks that really are very knowledgeable and that contributed to the different chapters within it.
Well, and they really are incredibly interesting. And there's, you know, there's, I just sort of flip to any page of it. And it's a sort of fun way to jump into the book and to jump into having you be a co-host tonight. So if you've tuned in late, folks, you're listening to Cat Chat and Dog Talk, a new Dr. Sean tonight as a guest co-host, because our usual Dr. Sean, the natural vet, is away. So it's Dr. Sean Delaney, who's a veterinary nutritionist. He actually is board certified. There's only a small handful of vets who are that interested in nutrition. And it really is quite extraordinary. Be careful if you ask him a question, because you get a much more complex and interesting answer than just yes or no, or dry food versus wet food. There's so much more that goes into it. But one of the things that people suffer from, their animals suffer from so much, and creates so much heartache for the animals and for the people, is skin problems. And there, you have a chapter, Nutritional Management of Skin Diseases, with some pictures of dogs and cats that many of us have seen this in our own dogs and cats. They're not really what is often in the layman referred to as a hot spot, but they're a dermatitis that generic dog food dermatosis. Now, can you just talk about that idea? Because my understanding was that skin problems in pets, dogs or cats, are very, 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 very rarely caused by food. They're usually environmental for the most part. And yet this chapter suggests that there are skin problems that can be identified as being from pet food.
Yeah, there's a lot of, I guess, nutrients that are very important for skin quality. And a lot of folks recognize that in their own pets when they feed, I'll call it a more premium food. There's no real definition of that. But back, this is now going back into the 80s, with quote-unquote poor quality food, there were certain problems that dermatologists were seeing, and that's what they're reporting to, and they just called generic dog food dermatosis. And if you go and are old enough, you may even remember there used to be food that would be just in these gigantic bins, and you'd scoop it out, and it was very literally as generic as possibly can be generic. It wasn't even packaged. And certain nutrients that, you know, might have been limiting in those foods, meaning that it could be that there was, you know, different vitamin deficiencies or mineral deficiencies or fatty acid deficiency or amino acid deficiencies. All of those potential deficiencies with those foods could manifest in skin disease, or synergistically could act upon the body's skin and the ability to reproduce skin cells. And it makes sense. I think that folks most commonly remember the importance of nutrition when they think about rapidly dividing cells, and unfortunately think about the effects of things like chemotherapy or radiation. And those, when people undergo chemotherapy or radiation, you're affecting the most rapidly dividing cells. And what happens? You get often people losing their hair. They often will have, you know, issues with their skin quality. They may also have GI issues because the lining of the GI tract is also very rapidly dividing. And so anything that's rapidly dividing has an increased need for essential nutrients. And it's very common for those parts of the body that need nutrients, i.e. the skin and the hair, to really show up when there's a problem. And it's one of the things that we say, how does the animal look overall on a diet, that we use as a very broad brush to say, is it working or is it not working, and is it providing a good nutritional plane for the animal?
So that's one of the – so when people say, well, should I feed this food or the other food, we often do say to them, whether we're vets or me, well, how does your animal look and feel? Does he or she seem to have good energy and, you know, seem to be not too fat, not too thin, kind of the Goldilocks shape? And how does their fur look?
Absolutely.
And if the fur looks shiny and healthy, that is a sign that that food is probably agreeing with them. So when dog food, and luckily probably in the days when you used to scoop out your own dog food from a big old bin and it was pretty mediocre ingredients, cats in those days didn't much live in the house. And we're not talking 100 years ago. We're talking probably 40 or 50, right?
Well, I maybe I'm dating myself, but I can think of at least 10 or 15 years ago of still seeing places where there were bins of food. But yeah, I definitely think that over the last 20 to 30 years, cats have become predominantly indoor, at least in I would call it the North American geography.
Right.
And that has a lot of interesting consequences, which may be what you're leading to, because it does affect what they eat. meaning that they probably increased the reliance on commercial food as they live more and more indoor. I'm hoping that people don't have large infestations of rodents in their home. but certainly cats can be excellent mousers, and there's a really great segment a few years ago, or maybe more than a few years ago, of a city or a town or a village in England where they recorded all the mice that cats brought back to their owners as prizes. I always like that cats do that. And they were amazed at probably the effect and the population control that the local quote-unquote house cats were having on the rodent population. And it was in the thousands of rodents that they were killing on an annualized basis. And they theorized that if the cats weren't there, that the town would have been overrun with mice and rats probably. And so anyway, there are cats that are certainly going to be eating rodents and probably going back to more of an evolutionarily appropriate diet than maybe dry food, which I know is a big area of your interest. Yeah, exactly. So it's an interesting.
But I see that. But I see a picture in this chapter, and I've had kitties and seen kitties that had this kind of bald, kind of pinkish reddish area where their ear kind of joins their head near their eye, and it has a name which I can't even begin to pronounce. But it says confirmed cutaneous adverse food reaction. So, are there some situations in which skin problems are not about environmental allergies, but certain skin conditions that if you are that very either well-trained veterinary nutritionist or well-trained veterinary dermatologist, you can look at it and go, oh, of course, that's from food reaction. That's not environmental reaction.
Yeah, and there is some cues to that. And pruritus, or which is just a fancy way of saying itchiness, and it can manifest itself as licking or scratching or even biting. Those types of signs are often associated with one of three things in cats. One could be a flea allergy, another could be environmental allergies, or it could be associated with a food allergy. And food allergy is often attempted to be ruled out or included or treated solely because if flea control, which can be done now, we have great, you know, topical and oral medications to do that. If that alone doesn't bring down the itchiness, then you're left with, is it food or environmental allergens? And environmental allergens are really tricky to treat because they're everywhere, and they can be, you know, anything from pollen to dust mites to, you know, things that are just ubiquitous in the environment. And so to try to control that, you're either using drugs, which people sometimes don't avoid, and things like we would use in humans for hay fever, like antihistamines, or even more, you know, a stronger medication, something like a steroid, or they even will go to the level of doing hyposensitization shots, where just like people, they will give, you know, a small dose of the allergen under the skin on a regular basis to try to decrease the overall reaction to it. That's obviously lifelong medication and or shots is not something that's very easy, whereas potentially changing the diet can be helpful. And what you find is that even if an animal has environmental allergies, if you treat their flea allergy and you treat their food allergy, you sometimes can bring them below the threshold that causes them to itch or to cause self-trauma to themselves. And so food becomes a very important part in treating some of these animals. And it can be very, very sad because they can have such severe pruritus that they're, as you kind of called a hotspot, they're basically chewing themselves to the point where they're making their skin or flesh raw, because it's anyone who's had an itch will know that sometimes an itch can be even worse than pain.
Much worse than pain. And then of course, scratching and itching, that's the self trauma, which then turns it into a hotspot, which then is infected and is a suppurating sore. And then you've got to deal with that with antibiotics and maybe more steroids, and it becomes this horrible merry-go-round. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk about how you know, I mean, if it's just the food elimination trial that Dr. Donna has talked about on The Expert Vet, that'll be interesting. But it says confirmed cutaneous adverse food reaction. So it's been confirmed that the skin is showing a bad reaction to food. So I want to learn more about that, because so many people ask me about itchy skin, and I've come to say, look, it's environmental, and you've got to deal with all the things that Dr. Donna talked about, like wash the bedding all the time, rinse and wipe the dog off, Don't let them out at high pollen times. Use air filters. But I want to know more about the food and these skin problems, because I think it's one of the biggest problems that people have. We're going to go to a quick break. When we come back, feel free to join us, 888-627-6008. We'll be right back. Waruva is a privately owned company that makes pet food in a human food facility, so it's good enough for you to eat. All the flavors of Waruva, Cats in the Kitchen, and their more economical BFF, Best Feline Friend brands are great for finicky little dogs and choosy cats, especially those you're trying to transition away from dry foods, which Waruva chooses not to make because carbohydrates are inappropriate for an obligate carnivore, and they believe your pussycat deserves to eat as well as you do. This show is also supported by the pheromone products Feelaway for cats and Adaptil for dogs. Pheromones are chemical communicators that are a natural signal of comfort in your pet's brain. Adaptil can help with problems like separation anxiety in dogs, and Feelaway diffusers can reduce problems in a multi-cat household. Veterinary behaviorists often recommend Feelaway and Adaptil as stress relievers to solve behavior problems. Pheromones can help adopted cats and dogs make the adjustment to their new home and comfort young puppies and kittens who have just left their litters. Look for Feelaway and Adaptil at RadioPetLady.com, where you can buy them from Dr. Sean's online store, PetCareNaturally.com. This show is also brought to you by Nordic Naturals for people and their pets. Research shows that even the best diets are deficient in the essential fatty acids found in their omega-3 oils. Nordic Naturals uses sustainably sourced wild fish from healthy stocks with third-party testing to guarantee purity and freshness. Nordic Naturals Omega Pet products bring the same health benefits to the cats and dogs in your family when you add Nordic Naturals Omega-3 fish oil to their bowls every day. We are back. I'm here with Dr. Sean Delaney, who is the pet food advisor on our Thursday night show on the network, Pet Food Advisors. And he's here with me tonight if you have any questions about your dogs and cats and feeding them. We're talking about this chapter in, to me, your absolutely fascinating textbook. And to anyone who's just interested in nutrition for humans or animals, it's just so, so interesting. My plumber actually today, Dr. Sean, asked about his bulldog. He's always had bulldogs, and this dog is getting hot spots that are infected. And so I immediately said, well, is it seasonal? Yes. Well, then it's in the environment, and you know, don't all the things I just mentioned about the pollen and the air cleaners and bedding. But I see in this chapter, there's actually a little subsection, lethal acrodermatitis in white bull terriers. Now, I know that all bulldogs and bull terriers, particularly white ones, have some genetic similarity, right? They all come from kind of a similar stock. What is it that can happen with bulldogs? They have such digestive problems anyway. What is this lethal dermatitis that they can get?
It's a pretty rare disease, and it's not seen very commonly, but this is a textbook, and so we tried to be as, I guess, thorough. It was written by one of my colleagues. Most of the textbook was written by boarded nutritionists. This was written actually by a boarded internist who is also a boarded dermatologist by the name of Catherine Outerbridge. Yeah, very smart lady. And so she was comprehensive in her addressing of different diseases. And so it is a genetic disease that white bull terriers get. It's not one that as a nutritionist we deal very often. It looks similar to a zinc deficiency. So there's a discussion about, well, would, you know, zinc supplement be of help? And in essence, not really. And it's one of those things where we kind of are at a disadvantage in treating. And one of the hopes, I think, with some of these diseases, similar to if we talk about Dalmatians with urate urolithiasis, which we deal with as a nutritionist far more often,
right.
That we hope that we can breed out of the breed. And that's, you know, one of the, I guess, challenges with what we have done with dogs and to a lesser extent cats is that we have genetically modified them severely from the wolf. And in doing so, traits that we saw as attractive, whether it may be their white coloring in this case or some other feature, had other traits that maybe not were in the best interest of the animal. And so we have taken genes that are close together, let's say on a chromosome, and taken them along with us My own personal dog is a Boston Terrier, and she, unfortunately, now in her older age, has what's called corneal endothelial degeneration. It's a known disease, probably has a genetic component because it's seen regularly in Boston Terriers, where her cornea basically starts to get too much water in it, and it loses its clarity, and all of a sudden you run into them becoming less and less visual, and they can't see as well. No problem for my dog. I'm not moving any furniture, and she's learning where to go and things like that. But it's a better, I think the better global statement rather than this particular disease is to recognize that, you know, we pick breeds and we pick certain traits, and that may make them more likely to have diseases. Some of those diseases are things that we deal with nutritionally. So in this case, she really pointed it out to say, you're not going to get a lot of benefit out of doing anything dietarily. Right. Whereas if we were talking about a Dalmatian and urolithiasis, we definitely make some very significant changes to their diet to help them with that disease. Or, you know, miniature schnauzers are known, for example, to have what almost many people have in the developed world of having hypercholesterolemia and hypertriglyceridemia, more hypertriglyceridemia, and that's genetically a predisposition. And you can help them with a very low-fat diet, for example. So,
and usually in dogs, cholesterol is irrelevant. It's not even mentioned, right, for the average dog.
That's absolutely right. Triglycerides we worry about because at high enough levels it may predispose them to pancreatitis. It can also predispose them to having seizures. But in the dog, cholesterol is not a worry because unlike you or I, they carry their cholesterol on a better form of cholesterol, if you will. You know, we always hear about good cholesterol and bad cholesterol.
Yes.
Dogs carry it more on good cholesterol. They also, if you think about it, unfortunately, even the longest lived dogs don't live as long as humans. And so plaque formation in the coronary artery takes a long time. There's fortunately not a lot of 20-year-old, you know, humans dying of coronary artery disease, but not too many dogs make it to 20. And so it's a combination of how they carry their cholesterol as well as not living as long, most likely, that they'd never, and I'll reemphasize that they never, dogs never die of a heart attack as we think of it, or a myocardial infarction, where basically the artery feeding the muscle of the heart isn't getting enough blood supply because there's been a burst of a plaque in its artery, and now it's blocking blood flow. That doesn't happen in dogs. They don't die of heart attacks. Now, people say, well, my dog died of heart attack. That may be that they died of heart failure. We certainly see dogs that, you know, their heart enlarges and it can't contract as well. That can be dietary related. Taurine deficiency has been seen in the dog, and that causes what's called dilated cardiomyopathy. There can be valvular disease where dogs have a valve in their heart or valves in their heart where they don't seal during the contraction and the pumping of blood, and we do deal with that dietarily as well, just like in people.
And that's like the Cavalier King Charles Spaniel. That's quite in that breed, isn't it?
That's a
mitral valve problems.
Absolutely. Prolapse of the mitral valve, meaning it's going in the wrong direction, is seen in that breed. A lovely breed, but if you talk to any veterinarian, whenever you bring up a specific breed, we worry about the diseases that they commonly have. And so whenever I see a poor King Charles, I think, oh my gosh, heart disease. Now, that's not really true, but if you're a veterinarian and they're coming in to see you because they're sick, that's a high rule out to figure out what's going on. But we will deal with
just a week ago, Dr. Sean, the natural vet, had to put his Cavalier King Charles Spaniel to sleep because her heart was failing. I mean, it was failing to the point that he couldn't even make it a couple of more hours.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of amazing that there's breeds that are this infiltrated with a deadly, fatal, you know, die too young kind of problem. And yet people keep getting them because they just have this affection for the breed. And I don't know if them wanting to get more of them is causing more breeding and therefore more indiscriminate breeding. But there's actually something dietary you can do for a cavy?
Yeah, so when they go into failure, fulminant failure, and that can be one of two things. Fulminant failure, heart failure, means that fluid is now either appearing in the chest or the abdominal cavities. And that fluid that accumulates can be reduced with a low-sodium diet. The other component with heart failure is that those dogs often are having a hard time getting enough calories in. We think about, and I mentioned at the beginning about humans that are getting chemotherapy, one of the other signs is that they often lose weight. We don't see oncology patients or cancer patients losing weight profoundly very often. It does happen, but not very often in veterinary medicine. What we do see is very underweight dogs with cardiac disease or heart disease. And part of that is that the fluid that they secrete into those, or that if that really not really even secrete, that leaks into their abdominal cavity or into their chest cavity is really nutrient rich. And to relieve them, you know, if you can imagine fluid around your lungs, it compressing them, it makes it harder to breathe, or if fluid is around your intestinal tract, it makes you feel not so good and not want to eat. Tapping that fluid or removing that fluid can make them feel better, but in doing so, you're removing this very nutrient-rich, you know, fluid, and that's a loss of calories. And so these dogs, besides them trying to constantly catch their breath, and then no matter how often you give them food, and I think I've told you on our show, you can imagine if you just ran the 100-yard dash and someone handed you the most appetizing meal you possibly could want, you still wouldn't be able to eat it very well. You eventually catch your breath, but in those animals, they don't catch their breath. And there's a lot of energy expended in trying to breathe. If you think about it, and you know, those animals will be panting and coughing. And so that coupled with tapping fluid out, they often are losing calories and they can become what we refer to as cachexic or very underweight and waste away. There's probably some hormonal effects as well that one of my colleagues who wrote the cardiac chapter, Dr. Lisa Freeman at Tufts University in the textbook talks about, and you can help that potentially with N3 fatty acids. So you may see N3 fatty acids used in a heart diet. You might see lower sodium. You might see it being more energy dense or higher in protein to try to deal with the protein losses.
The sodium. I thought that most dog food had barely any salt or sodium in it. And yet we all know that sodium is necessary for life. So is there actually a kind of like substantial amount of salt in a good quality commercial diet?
There's enough to meet their needs, but there's not a lot of sodium in comparison to what we would eat as humans. And I think if you were to think about it in terms of a pickle, it would help. We often think about, you know, pickle's a very lower calorie food. It's just cucumber that's been, you know, obviously pickled. No play on words there.
Right.
And it's high sodium and vinegar, and that those two things help preserve it. But the high sodium gives it about 15 grams of sodium per megacalorie. And a lot of you are going to go, what's that per megacalorie? It's a simple way of saying per 1,000 calories. It's the way most nutritionists will compare nutrient values amongst different foods that might vary in, you know, moisture level or fiber level. It just makes everything an even playing field, if you will. And so if we think about 15 grams per megacalorie, it would be very unusual for a pet food to have more than 1 gram per megacalorie. So that pickle would have 15 times the amount of sodium than maybe your typical pet food. And if you were making a diet for heart disease, you would severely restrict. And when I say restrict, it's not below the requirement, but lower than normal, down to being maybe less than 0.4 grams. Per megacalorie, even down to 0.2 grams per megacalorie. So very, very severe sodium restriction. If you ever eat pet food, it's very bland. It's chalky a little bit because of all the calcium and minerals in it. And what's very interesting about eating pet food is that when you salt pet food, and I say this from personal experience, a lot of the flavor comes out, and it has a lot more flavor to it because we just are getting – when we eat food, even though I don't salt my food almost at all, we are used to a higher sodium intake than dogs or cats are used to.
That is an amazing fact that our dog's food would be more tasty for us if we salted it up a bit.
Well, I didn't say it would be tasty. You would taste it more. I didn't necessarily say it would be more tasty. In fact, I have a little anecdote about this. Years ago, I was at the university and I was being interviewed by a San Jose Mercury News reporter. And she came in and she was fascinated by the fact that we had all these different bins of different therapeutic foods. And I was saying, oh, this food does this food and this food is. And then she asked me if I ever tasted any of them. And I said, yeah, I actually do. And these were all dry kibble that we were looking at. And she goes, can I try some? And I said, well, if you really are venturesome and want to. And so I tried her out on a product that's made for food allergy out of soy hydrolysate. So it's been broken down. It's all vegetarian in essence with a little bit, I think, chicken fat maybe or some animal fat in it, but mostly vegetarian. So it's a very bland flavor. And when you eat it, it tastes kind of like almost, even though it's not corn, it tastes like a corn chip or some kind of a, you know, snack food, but without as much salt. And so she tasted it and she goes, that's not so good. She goes, it'd be better with a little salt. So we added some salt. We made homemade diets there. So we had salt and she goes, that's better. And she goes, and I said, well, you know, salt really brings out the flavor. And she goes, yeah. She goes, is there any food that has more salt? And there is a food that's made for animals that need to drink more water to deal with kidney stones. And so it's actually about 2 grams per megacalorie, so about double the higher level of sodium level. So I gave it to her, and she pops it in her mouth, and she's already eaten, you know, she's now experienced. She's already eaten one kibble of food. And she goes, she goes, it does have more flavor. And I go, I said, what do you think? And she goes, it kind of tastes like fresh manure. And I went, oh, my gosh, let me get you some water. And I felt horrible for her. And this is the part that's bizarre. She said to me, and I quote, No, in a good way. And I tell this story, and I never have understood how fresh manure could, you know, taste in a good way. But I think she just meant it felt like tasted like the farm.
Oh, my goodness. But it's a little bit like you don't want to ask the next question, and would this be from personal experience?
Exactly.
In fact, just today for this week's show on The Expert Vet, I was actually asking Dr. Donna about dogs eating deer droppings, rabbit droppings, and if there were worms or other parasites that they could pick up, and that really my dogs don't think anything is better than a freshly baked mini donkey brownie, which is basically freshly dropped. And I've never really stopped to think what would that flavor be and what could be and how could that be in a good way. Well, on this note, we're going to take a break, and when we get back, this generic dog for food dermatosis, the idea that one of the less good quality dog foods can really give you a skin condition as a dog. That's something I really didn't know. Obviously, we'd all like to be feeding the best possible quality food and more variety and more different ingredients, but I didn't know you could actually get bad skin from a cheap, lousy dog food. So when we get right back from this break, we're going to find out, never mind the brand name, because they don't even have names. It's a good reason to invest in better nutrition. We'll be right back. VaxaCheck wants to know, are you worried about the harmful side effects of over-vaccinating your dog? But is your vet worried whether your dog still has protection from previous vaccinations? VaxaCheck is a new blood titer test done right in your vet's office that shows whether your dog has immunity to the deadly core diseases and needs revaccination or not. VaxaCheck should be used on puppies to confirm whether their puppy shots really worked. Shelters should use VaxaCheck on new arrivals to separate healthy dogs from unprotected ones. VaxaCheck, for your dog's safety and your peace of mind. And VaxaCheck for cats is coming soon. This show is brought to you by Halo Holistic Natural Dog and Cat Foods, which are made from real ingredients you can recognize. Read the ingredients on the label of your own dry dog food. Can you identify what's in there? Halo uses real meat in their kibble, no rendered byproducts, chicken meal, or chemicals. The company emphasizes giving back by making donations to shelters through freekibble.com because Halo believes less fortunate felines and canines deserve great nutrition too. Halo is a private company partly owned by Ellen DeGeneres, where they are genuinely dedicated to keeping your pet happy and healthy inside and out. Precious Cat Litter is privately owned by Dr. Elsie, a feline-only veterinarian whose litters are designed to appeal to kitties and protect their health. His renowned Catatrack litter has a blend of herbs which entice cats into the litter box. Respiratory Relief litter is low dust for pussycats with asthma, which makes it healthy for people and other pets in the family too. And there are special litters for long-haired and senior cats as well. Precious Cat donates litter to shelters and rescues across the country. I am back with Dr. Sean, the pet food advisor, the editor, co-editor of this really great textbook that every time I open it, I have 200 questions for you. Generic dog food dermatosis. So this was apparently first, according to the book, reported in the 1980s that poor quality dog food showed up with a very specific kind of a skin problem. They even have a photo of it on a young Labrador retriever. So are there skin conditions that you see them and you think, aha, that is from a lousy food?
You know, we don't see what I would call generic dog food dermatosis anymore, at least in the U.S. that I have recognized.
Okay.
We do see, though, some similar, I guess, manifestations in specific scenarios. And the reason for that is that, you know, although in the 80s we had, you know, these reports – the industry, I would say, overall did a good job of recognizing it. And we, back in the early 90s, there were the AFCO nutrient profiles were adopted, and those set up some guidelines about what were the minimum values you needed to have in a pet food to say that it was a complete and balanced product for specific life stages. And I think that work really had a profound beneficial effect on preventing some of the things we would see back in the 80s. And that certainly predates my time as being a board of nutritionists. But where I would say we still see issues, and where maybe people can more relate to that, is that often when folks have animals that are overweight or obese, they may on their own start to restrict how much they're feeding of the food. And in doing so, if they restrict it severely enough, they may notice some of the coat quality and issues that were reported. Often they may just say that they notice some scaling, or they might notice that the sheen has been lost. And that may be that, you know, that they have restricted the food down enough that the essential nutrients that need to come into the animal are no longer meeting their needs. Because I think what people may not realize is that when you formulate a pet food, you formulate it to an amount per unit of energy generally. So I talked about earlier about per megacalorie when we were talking about sodium. Well, all the nutrients are defined by an amount per energy, so that if you eat enough calories in a given day to sustain yourself and to maintain your weight as a dog or a cat, you should then get enough of the nutrients. But if you restrict yourself down to, let's say, 60 or 70% of your normal caloric intake in order to achieve some weight loss because you're a little pudgy, you could potentially restrict the nutrients down below the requirement, because the requirement for nutrients doesn't decrease because you need to lose weight. And so it's not uncommon to have concerns about amino acids, about fatty acids, about maybe certain minerals, trace minerals, going below the requirement with restriction. And that's why there are special diets for active weight loss where the amount of nutrients per unit of energy or per 1,000 calories are higher, so that as you restrict them, they still get all the vitamins and minerals and amino acids they need. And so that's one example where you may see it. It's certainly also not uncommon that if someone has a really, what I'll say is an easy keeper, an animal that just doesn't need a lot of calories to maintain their weight, they're not actively trying to have them lose weight, but they're trying to maintain their weight. If they have a very lower, I'll say a lower cost food that is just meeting the requirements, and they feed a little bit less than they anticipated the average animal would need, because you have to remember that the energy requirements that we use, the best ones we have, can be off by plus or minus 50%, plus or minus 50%. So if you're an animal that only needs 50% of what the average animal needs, and you're right at the cusp, you might start to notice that on your easy keeper, as you restrict them so that they don't gain too much weight, that some of their coat sheen and their quality deteriorates or is worsened. And that may be another animal that might benefit from a higher or more premium food that might have more nutrients per calorie.
Or you could supplement with a really high quality. Your company Balance, it happens to make an additive for home cooking for an animal who doesn't have any problems, but the people want to home cook. And isn't that the idea behind Balance It? That by giving the right amount per the weight of the dog of that supplement, that you are covering, I don't know this, we've actually never really talked about it, but that it creates kind of an umbrella of coverage of giving the animal all that it needs?
What we do is really work for folks who are home cooking with human foods that are not already fortified. And so if, let's say, that you were feeding a lower quality food, I guess I'm not a good business person, but I'm probably a better veterinarian, I would say spend more money on a more premium food rather than buying a supplement from us or from anyone else.
Yeah, but wait one second, because if I have a dog, I have two of my three dogs are – I'm trying to get them to lose some weight. Now, most people saw them, they think they look great. But I know that they've got 5 or 10% more body weight, given that they have severe arthritis and are getting older. And the more arthritis, the more sedentary they become, so they're not burning energy. And I'm using, as it turns out, Halo kibble, because I like what its ingredients are. But I would guess that on the bag it says that for an 80-pound dog, I've never even checked, it's probably like some tons of cups, because so often the dog food labels seem to tell you to give obscene amounts of these dry foods. Now, from what you're telling me, it's probably because then it would technically cover that whole nutrient profile. But if I'm giving one of those dogs half a cup at each meal, which is what I'm giving her, with some other stuff, but I'm only giving her half a cup of that kibble and maybe 6 cups is the full serving to get the nutrient profile. That person feeding a very super premium, high quality food, but way less than the prescribed amount or the suggested amount, then they should be supplementing, right?
Well, I would argue that they would want to talk to the company to get a, what's referred to as a typical analysis. So often on the bag, there'll be what's called a guaranteed analysis. It's a value of what the minimum values for certain regulatory required nutrients, depending on what you're stating. So the bare minimum would be protein, fat, crude fiber, and moisture. That really doesn't tell you a whole lot. It can give you a little bit of information about the calories and where they're coming from amongst protein, fat, and carbohydrate. But what you would want is to talk to the company and say, do you have a typical analysis that tells me what all the essential nutrients are? Many companies will provide that. I'm not familiar with Halo to know what their policy is with regard to that. But let's say that they could provide you with that. Then I would argue that you would want to go and determine with some help what the limiting nutrients are. So as you restrict it down below the, you know, average amount that's normally taken in, what nutrients start to slip below what they should get on a daily basis? Right. And let's say it was just linoleic acid. So that's the essential N6 fatty acid that dogs and cats need. Cats need a second one as well. But that comes in the form in very rich amounts from things like corn oil or walnut oil. If that's the only nutrient that's starting to, you know, go a little bit below the requirement and everything else is well above it, then maybe the best choice is just to put a little dab or a little bit amount, and, you know, obviously you calculate how much, of corn oil on top of the kibble, and then away you go. Well, what if it's, in this particular case, it's in fact a trace mineral, let's say it's zinc. And so then maybe going to your, you know, local health food store and getting a zinc supplement and adding it in. What we make is a very concentrated vitamin, mineral, and amino acid supplement when there are very little amounts in the overall diet. Taking our supplement, for example, would be like using a nuclear bomb. It would be so much more potentially than you need, because when you look at a typical vitamin supplement that's sold over the counter in, let's say, the pet store, they do it in a very safe way. They use nutrients that have a very safe high level of tolerance. So B vitamins very commonly, or if it's a vitamin that may have some toxicity, they put very little of it in there just so that it appears on the label. And what that does is they know that most people are adding it into an already complete and balanced or completely fortified food, so that they add the supplement or the vitamin in, they aren't going to create toxicity. And that's a very respectable and appropriate approach to doing that. A very common tablet that existed that were used by veterinarians, I won't name, when we started doing this, you know, 8 years ago, we took a look in the tablet and we said, what if we wanted to make the equivalent amount of one scoop of our product, which was a teaspoon amount, so 5 milliliters for anyone that thinks in the metric system, so not a lot of volume. It would take 40 of the same tablets, which were almost the same volume, to equal the same amount of nutrients, and it was still missing some. And that wasn't because there was a problem with their product. It was just designed to do something very different, and it was designed to be safely added on to complete and balanced food. So
a little booster rather than a real supplementation for something that's entirely missing.
Right.
And it does give me – I mean, hearing all this gives me a lot of respect for pet food manufacturers and what has to go into it, because when any of these ingredients are out of balance, the animal can get ill or not look great or not feel great. I mean, I don't think most of us that are what we call ourselves pet foodies, as Dr. Donna, the expert vet, calls herself and me, and many of us that are interested in these topics, we don't really realize that it's serious stuff. You just don't throw in some chicken, some carrots, and some rice and call it a day. There's really a lot more to it. I'd love to take this call from Tyrone, who's calling. Welcome to Cat Chat and Dog Talk, Tyrone. Great to have you here.
Oh, how y'all doing this evening?
Excellent. What can we help you with?
Well, no matter what, if I clean them, scrub them off good, use dog shampoo, condition, all that stuff, he smells bad no matter what.
Your dog smells bad no matter what. What kind of a dog, Tyrone?
I don't want to shave him. My wife don't like that type of stuff to be gross, but, you know, he smells, so I don't know what to do.
All right, so tell us what kind of dog he is.
He's just a mutt. We pick him up off the side of the street, you know what I mean?
Sure, that was very nice of you, but is he a long-haired mutt?
No, it's short, it ain't long, and he don't really shit that bad, but it smells and it get greasy really, really fast. It just gets greasy.
That's an interesting question. What are you feeding him?
Just get really greasy.
What do you feed him, Tyrone?
I give him treats when I eat. I give him some scraps and he get his normal dog food, kibble and bits, you know what I mean? Some of the knockoff brand from Walmart.
Oh, kibble and bits, Tyrone. I need you to spend a little time on my website, because Dr. Sean will be more diplomatic than me. But that food has so much chemicals, so much fake colors, fake flavors, scary ingredients. It's made to look really attractive to the pet owner who buys it. But the stuff that's in it, I'm pretty sure the number one ingredient is corn, and it kind of goes downhill from there.
You're making my dog all smelly and stuff? Is it people doing that?
Well, I can't say it's only that brand, but I can say that a brand of food full of fake ingredients, chemicals, additives, not natural ingredients.
What would be a brand that you recommend me to buy for my dog from Walmart, you know what I mean?
You want to buy it at Walmart. Dr. Sean, before I answer that, would a food contribute to greasy skin and a smelly dog?
I think it depends on where the smell is coming from. And, you know, I think what I don't know, and obviously have not ever seen Tyrone's dog, is that there's something else going on. I have certainly seen where food can make an animal smell differently. For example, people who are on a fish diet with their dog, the dog will start to emit a fish smell.
I'm sorry, I didn't tell you guys this. When I found him, he was covered in some weird-looking liquid. It was all green, and it smelled really bad. I had to scrub it off. But you think that could have a... It was all green and weird, and it kind of burned my finger when I touched it, but, you know, I washed it off and everything, but you know what I mean?
The poor dog, somebody had thrown some chemical on him?
I don't know if it was no chemical, but I got it off him quickly. I was like, hey, I don't want my dog getting all, you know, it'd be dirty.
So I think one thing you could do is buy oatmeal shampoo. I don't know if Walmart has it, but any pet store has it. You want to get a non-soap shampoo for the dog.
You think if there was a chemical on a dog, you could have, you know, messed him up internally, made him smell from the inside, you know what I mean?
Probably not, but I think the first thing to do would be to get his fur and skin gently clean, so you'd want to use a non-soap pet shampoo, something like a lot of
people
like oatmeal.
I thought he just might have smelly balls, you know what I mean?
Well, that's all possible, but I think the first thing you want to do is try to get a really nice mild shampoo, and then I would go with a higher quality food. We need to go to our break, Tyrone, but if you want to learn more about some different pet foods that you can consider, it all has to do with what's on the label and what the ingredients are. And if you go to RadioPetLady.com, it'll give you a link back to my website, and there's hundreds of pages that I've written in there. You don't have to buy the Dog Bible for free. You go to RadioPetLady.com, go back over to my website, and read a little bit about some of those ingredients, and I think you'll see a really big difference.
And maybe see a vet.
And definitely see your vet. But I'm really glad that you called. So glad that you called. Keep on listening. We're going to go to a break right now. We'll be right back. This show is brought to you by Vectra 3D for Dogs, a safe and effective topical anti-tick and flea treatment that you put on your dog's skin once a month to repel parasites with the newest technology. Vectra 3D creates a shield on your dog's skin that repels ticks and kills them fast and reliably for the entire month, while being safe for the people in your family. Older products do not last the full 30 days and only kill ticks that bite your dog, which can actually transmit the many tick-borne diseases. Vectra for cats and dogs who live where there are no ticks is the anti-flea topical treatment that kills all three life cycles of the flea. Vectra is only available from practicing veterinarians. To learn more and find out how your own vet can get the Vectra products, go to RadioPetLady.com. Support for this show comes from The Honest Kitchen, a family-owned company that makes dehydrated pet foods from 100% human-grade ingredients. Lucy at The Honest Kitchen knows that the least processed foods are the most nutritious and developed her unique foods based on this principle. The Honest Kitchen's all-natural, clean, safe products can assist dogs and cats with chronic health issues like itchy skin, ear infections, and digestive problems, which are often linked to a diet of poor quality or highly processed ingredients. Just add water to the dry mix to create a fresh, warm, healthy meal for your cat or dog. Go to RadioPetLady.com to call The Honest Kitchen for a free consultation about which recipe is right for your pet and to get free samples. I'm back with Dr. Sean. We're getting towards the end of Cat Chat and Dog Talk tonight. Dr. Sean, I do hear, and I'm sure you have heard too, because you have a lot of clients, both veterinarians and owners, who come to you saying, I'm sick of commercial pet food. I'm cooking for my dog. And please give me balance it in the right proportion so that I can home cook and not worry about the zinc and the N6 and the N3 and so forth. But I have often heard of people that were feeding a supermarket brand of dog food. So just pick an easy way of saying a lower quality dog food. You might not agree with me in that assessment, but it's just an easy rule of thumb that most surely the dog foods that are sold in the supermarket tend to be very corn-based and have lots of artificial ingredients, just like those center aisles for humans have corn chips and potato chips that aren't even potato chips. They're made of other things, and drinks made of fake colors, fake flavors. It's all sugar and a lot of chemicals and artificial stuff. And when people stop feeding one of those foods and just go to, in their case, they want to home cook, but they could just go to a super premium food, a very high quality food, where if you look at the ingredients list, you feel good about it instead of like scared about it. It does seem to change what their skin looks like. So the skin is what? Our largest organ of discarding waste, right? On our whole body, our dogs and our cats, isn't it?
Well, I would say it's a very outward sign of health and always has been. And I think that that's why when there's a problem, and it can be all sorts of problems, it may not even be dietary, there can be effects on the coat quality. And so I don't know that I would characterize all grocery foods as the same. I would say that there is differences in foods based on price, because in order to make a food very inexpensive, you have to make some very specific decisions if you're the one mm-hmm. making it. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you just can't afford to make it. And in doing so, you may make choices that some folks prefer not to have made. So I'm not ever, a naysayer, or I never speak ill of anyone's approach to making food. And I realize that there's a lot of different options for a lot of different folks. And for some folks, certain foods are seen as very bad for animals. I'm not convinced of that as a general rule. I think there's a lot of foods that can adequately feed animals.
Well, I mean, certainly as a basis of, you know, can it sustain life? Can the animal survive on it? I mean, for sure they can. There, any food in any supermarket in America is better than anything that any dog in a third world country gets out of a dumpster or off the street. And those dogs live a fairly long life, and they look really terrible, but they survive. So, you know, they're definitely survivors. I was really talking in terms of what the skin and the outward appearance of the dog, and often when people sort of turn their back on those kind of foods that are less expensive for a good reason because they have less expensive ingredients, or the less expensive ingredients are sort of sexied up with artificial flavors and colors for, you know, attractiveness sake. A lot of these skin problems seem to resolve. And I guess that doesn't mean it's a food allergy. It just means it's a kind of health reaction to what you're eating. You kind of, I mean, that saying, you are what you eat. I guess there has to be something to that. And even for these kitties, I mean, in your textbook, pictures of dogs and cats with skin conditions that they specifically say, this is a reaction to food. Lower quality food. They don't say it's a reaction to a great food and this individual animal just, it doesn't agree with them. I think they're sort of saying, at least in this various research, that these horrible conditions on these animals really could probably be resolved with just, you know, go to a better quality food and make sure that the supplements are all balanced. We've sort of run out of time, but I have to say, this is the kind of conversation I love having with you that we have on Pet Food Advisors every week. And I hope that people that haven't had a chance to listen to it yet will know that you can download and listen on podcast to any of the shows. There's so much to be learned. And I must say, Sean, that I really do feel that what you teach us about dogs and cats applies so much to the human side as well. Of course, you know, cats aren't little dogs and dogs aren't little people, and little people aren't just like a dog either or like a puppy. But I do think that there's a lot to be learned in just sort of common sense and understanding the relationship between what we put in our mouth and how we feel, and the same thing with our pets. And we just, you know, either have to take it more seriously or lighten up, depending on which end of the spectrum we're on, wouldn't you say?
Well, I think that one of the few things we do every day for our health is eat, and we have to always remember that.
That's really true. And you said a great line recently that I adored. You said something about farmers, and you said, I love farmers because I really like to eat. Thank you so much for spending time with all of us. It's always such a pleasure and so interesting. Have a great night. Thanks again.
You too.
Take care.